Our next case for argument this morning is National Organization for Women against Scheidler.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Excuse me, just one. Will you pause just a minute?
We wait.
So we meet again.
Both sides managed to find their seats. Ms. Klein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Laura Kleinman on behalf of plaintiffs' appellants, NOW and the Women's Health Clinics. This case began in 1986 when NOW sued various defendants for using force and threats of force to blockade clinics and otherwise prevent women from getting health services. In 2007, final judgment was entered for defendants. And by that point, several defendants had already settled. We've raised two primary issues, and this appeal concerns the bill of costs of the Scheidler defendants only. First, the district court erred by awarding defendants many costs where they hadn't met their burden under Section 1920. And second, principles of equity should have barred defendants' claim for costs entirely. As to the award itself, there's no dispute that under Section 1920, defendants had the burden to show that the costs that they claimed were actually incurred by them and were necessary to this litigation. Defendants didn't do either for many of the costs they requested, and the district court awarded them anyway. For instance, defendants didn't provide a shred of evidence that they incurred a single witness fee, yet the court awarded every cent they asked for in this category of costs. They also didn't prove that they incurred over $10,000 in deposition costs.
There's an affidavit on a form provided by the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts tracks the statutory language. Why isn't that evidence? I understand you might want to disagree with it. You might want to introduce conflicting evidence. Why isn't that a prima facie record from which the district court can act?
Your Honor, that affidavit simply cannot support this award of costs. It's first and foremost completely conclusory. It's only seven paragraphs long and states simply that all costs incurred were necessary to this case. It doesn't name...
One based on the form that the AO provides for exactly this purpose.
Should we throw that out
as insufficient?
Yes, Your Honor, because that affidavit doesn't state any category of costs. It doesn't state any specific expense. It's completely silent as to who incurred any given costs, and it doesn't say why any of the costs might have been necessary. As courts in this circuit have held, that type of affidavit can't support an award of costs once they've been challenged. And here, defendants didn't provide any additional evidence to support their claim. The witness fees, for example, are completely absent from the record. And the award of deposition costs was only supported by invoices. Defendants say that that's all that was required under Section 1920, but in a multi-defendant case like this, where defendants were sharing various expenses throughout the litigation and settled at various points, a mere invoice alone, sometimes directed to counsel who represented other defendants who weren't seeking costs here, doesn't show that the Scheidler defendants actually incurred the costs that they claimed. In addition to failing to prove that they incurred the costs, the Scheidler defendants failed to show that many of them were necessary to this case, as was their burden. For example, there's no evidence whatsoever to support the trial court's award of pretrial transcripts. Judge Norgal said that he relied on the 76 pages of documentation that defendants submitted in support of the pretrial transcripts, but a review of those documents shows that not one of them says anything about the need for any given transcripts. The district court also said that he relied on the length and complexity of the case, but as Sampson and other cases teach, the fact that a case was long and complicated has nothing to do with the need for any given transcript. As Your Honor mentioned, the only thing that Judge Norgal based his award on was the affidavit of defendant's counsel, Mr. Brekka, and as we argued in our briefs, the affidavit is woefully insufficient under Section 1924. Aside from awarding costs where defendants failed to meet their burden, the district court failed to make findings as required by this court's authority in Weihaupt. This error is clearly illustrated at A26, where the court summarily awarded defendants a second docketing fee, which defendants admit they didn't request or support with documentation. The court also failed to make meaningful findings for its award of deposition costs. For that award, we raised the objection that defendants hadn't proven that they actually paid for the costs that they claimed. In his order, Judge Norgal restated our no proof of payment objection and then overruled it without making any findings whatsoever as to whether defendants had or had not incurred those costs. This is exactly analogous to Wyhoff, where this court reversed a trial court for simply restating a party's objection and overruling it without any relevant explanation. In addition to all of the errors about dollars and cents, equitable principles should have barred defendants' claim for costs. First and foremost, defendants don't deny, nor could
have
they.
Have we ever required applicants to pester district judges to release their decisions faster?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but this case is not on all fours with any case that I've ever seen.
I understand it's not on all fours with any case. It's 28 years old. None of the other cases were 28 years old. But the underlying question, must litigants pester district judges to render decisions on pain of forfeiting the relief they have asked for, is a general one. Have we ever required that? You said no. Has any appellate court ever required that?
No, Your Honor, but the reason that this
and
case...
And would it make any sense to require that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In this case, the entire litigation was terminated in September of 2009.
Is there any indication in the record that the parties were told of that docket entry, or of that note in the court's records?
Any time that a party clicked on the ECF website to review the docket...
That's not my question.
Not the question.
There's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, other than Judge Norgal saying that parties were notified in his motion, in his order on the motion
for ruling.
Of course,
I don't understand the significance of that anyway. I mean, it's well understood that the decision on the merits and the decision on costs are separately appealable orders. Every day, district courts enter orders saying, this case is terminated. That doesn't cut off the right to seek costs or imply that costs have been decided without an order.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the defendants waited an entire 2 years before the case was terminated. And
yes.
And defendants don't deny that they knew that the case was terminated. And as they later argue, they were waiting for a ruling on this motion.
All right. They were waiting, they say. Why didn't you pester the district judge?
Your Honor, we weren't seeking anything. And when the district court closed the case without a ruling, we assumed that our objections were
It is sometimes said that attorneys are officers of the court with some obligation to help the court do its job. If either side thinks, if there's some obligation to tell the court something on pain of relief, on pain of forfeiture, why isn't that equally applicable to both sides? Or we just give up on this idea that attorneys have duties to the court as well as to their client?
No, I don't think we give up on that idea, Your Honor, but in this case, we assumed that the defendants had abandoned their costs when they failed to comply.
What in the world would make you think that they had abandoned their request for costs? They didn't file a document withdrawing it. All we know is they filed the document and they waited more than 3 years for the district court to rule.
Well, in addition to that, Your Honor, we know that the document they filed wasn't compliant with Judge Kaur's July 19, 2007 order to meet and confer with us promptly and in good faith and to file a joint statement.
That might be a ground for denying the request, although the district judge in the end didn't deny it. It's certainly not a ground for saying the applicants weren't serious about their request for cause. But just get back to my question. If there is some obligation to tell a district judge on pain of some forfeiture that there is some thing under advisement that needs attention, why don't the lawyers for all litigants have that obligation?
In this case, Your Honor,
I'm not asking about this case. I'm asking about a general rule. What courts of appeals adopt is a rule of general application. Should we adopt such a rule? And if we adopt such a rule, shouldn't it apply to all lawyers?
Your Honor, I do believe that you should adopt a rule that says that when a case is terminated, a party waiting for a pending motion should file a motion for ruling if they want to keep that claim alive. That's not what happened in this case. In fact, defendants continue to say...
All right, you say that we should adopt such a rule, it would be the first time in American jurisprudence in more than 200 years, but courts sometimes do that. And then my second question, why shouldn't that duty be a duty of all lawyers?
Perhaps it should, Your Honor, and I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so if you don't have any further questions...
Well, if you say it should be a duty attaching to all lawyers, then your forfeiture was as great as theirs. Why should they be the worse for it?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the burden should be higher on them because they were the ones who were seeking costs from us. When they didn't comply with the district court's order to meet and confer in good faith or to file a joint statement at all, we assumed that they had abandoned their claim, and we further assumed it when the district court closed the case. Then, when they waited a year and a half and waited for the presiding judge with the institutional knowledge of the case to retire, they don't deny that they were taking strategic advantage of Judge Kaur's retirement. That type of gamesmanship is an abuse on the court system, and their claim for cost should be reversed on equitable grounds. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Kleinman. Mr. Levenberg.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ariel Lavenbuck for Defendants Appellees. I'd like to start by just briefly addressing whether or not Judge Norgel's 15-page opinion awarding $63,000 in taxable costs to the prevailing party in a two-decade litigation was an abuse of discretion, and then just at the end briefly turn to the issue of timeliness. We're aware of only two instances in which this Court has failed to affirm a district court's grant of taxable costs. In Weihaupt and Sanger, this court did so because the district court gave literally no explanation for its award. In contrast here, Judge Norville did anything other but rubber stamp the award. He issued a 15-page opinion that went through each of the categories of costs, and while he granted some, he denied others at his discretion. Now, I think there is, in fact, quite a big disagreement over how burdens work on the issues of taxable costs. So as this court has recognized in cases like SK Hand Tool, MT Bonk, and most recently in Halassa, a moving party has essentially two initial obligations. The first thing they need to do is they need to identify the cost that they seek and show that they fall within the categories enumerated in Section 1920 and provide reasonable documentation of those. The second thing they need to do is they need to swear, they need to verify that those costs were necessarily incurred. And we'll see on page A49 of the Joint Appendix, Form AO133, which Local Rule 54.1 requires parties in the Northern District of Illinois to file when they move for costs. And we'll see that that form directly tracks the two statutory requirements. On the top of the form, you see the categories listed in 1920, and a party simply needs to identify the sum that falls into each of those categories. And then there's a note that says, special note, attached to your bill an itemization of those costs. That's the provide all available documentation. In the second half of the form, it says declaration, and then there's language that tracks exactly what Section 1924 requires. An officer of the court needs to swear that those costs were necessary and reasonable. And as this court has recognized in Wall, in SK Hand Tool, in MT Bonk, and again most recently in Halassa, that's what a moving party needs to do. After that point, the burden shifts to the losing party to make an affirmative showing that costs weren't reasonable or necessary. It's not sufficient for them to simply say, well, you're the moving party and you didn't explain why it was necessary. No, we've done what we needed to do when we signed that affidavit. And the key point here is that the arguments, both for and against, were presented to Judge Norgel, and he considered them. And in his discretion, he found that plaintiff's points weren't enough to overcome the declaration. And we're aware of no opinion of this court or of any court holding that it is an abuse of the district court's discretion to rely on this statement, particularly when there isn't any affirmative evidence on the other side. Turning briefly to the issue of duplicativeness and whether or not certain costs were incurred or paid, it seems that there was a bit of shift between the opening brief and the reply brief as to what plaintiff's position was. In the opening brief, the argument was, well, you haven't shown that you paid these costs, to which we responded that neither the statute nor the case law requires that you show actual payment. You just need to show that they were incurred. This is a point that this court actually explicitly reached in SK Hand Tool, where the court said you don't need to provide receipts. You need to verify that you actually incurred these costs. Now, on the reply brief, they say, well, how do we know that the defendants actually incurred these costs and that it wasn't incurred by other defendants? Well, this argument was essentially presented to Judge Norville, and he said, I've reviewed the costs that were submitted by the various parties, and I found no duplication. He reached that finding. It wasn't an error for him to do so, and there's no affirmative evidence put in the record below that that was wrong. Briefly, to turn to the issue of timing, Your Honors mentioned that Rule 78.5 allows either party to bring to the court's attention a pending motion. Under that circumstance, it's hard to see what the prejudice could be for the delay of passage of time. But again, and this is my last point, the key point here is discretion. All of these arguments were made to Judge Norgal. He considered them, and no ruling of this court, or frankly any other court, has ever found it to be an abuse of discretion for a district court judge to grant a timely filed motion. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Unless you have any further questions, we rest on our brief. Ask that you affirm and award interest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ms. Kleinman, we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Defendants say that the seven-paragraph Brekka affidavit is all that is required under Section 1924. Not so. First, defendants ignore clear authority from courts all over this circuit saying that a conclusory affidavit alone cannot support an award of costs. Mortensen and Kamler, cited at page 4 in our reply, are just two examples. Second, the clear language of the statute, 1924, requires the prevailing party to explain why each item of costs was necessarily incurred for this case. Defendants don't argue, nor could they, that their affidavit came anywhere close to doing that. Third,
are you contending that costs can be awarded only with a document-by-document summary?
No, Your Honor, but the...
you just said each item.
That statute requires that there be more than a generic reference to all costs, which is what we have here. In addition to being conclusory, the Brekka affidavit wasn't even credible. Both Judge Holderman, who presided over the...
I don't see how an affidavit can be credible or not.
Your Honor, the affiant in this case...
Bad demeanor in the affidavit.
In this case, Your Honor, both Judge Holderman, who presided over the case from 1986 to 1994, and Judge Kaur questioned Mr. Brekka's honesty in open court. And, Your Honors, if a conclusory affidavit were all that was required, that would radically change the burden under Section 1920 and encourage this type of abuse of the system. We ask that this court reverse the award of costs entirely. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement for what is, I hope, the very last time.